Empire podcast this week, The End is Nigh. Yes, that's right. Bill Nighy, he pops in to talk about his new movie, The Limehouse Golem. And just to keep on a horror tip, Adam Wingard pops in to talk about his Netflix movie, Death Note. Oh, just in time for Halloween. All that and more on the movie podcast. I had a great day in the transfer deadline yesterday. I snapped up Ultron for just £4.50 from the Avengers. They had him out the back in a jumble sale type thing.
No, that doesn't make any really sense. Cheap. He wasn't on the team.
Well, he was hanging around. But £4.50, you're not going to argue with that, are you? James Spader in a mocap suit.
Yeah, fair.
Just walking around in a onesie.
Bargain.
Golly. Bargain.
I'd pay cheaper twice the price, in fact. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, which this week, for the final time, is sponsored by those lovable guys at Sky Atlantic and their new original revenge thriller, Tin Star, starring Tim Roth, Genevieve O'Reilly, Christina Hendricks, and a whole lot of bullets and snow. Will be coming to your screens from September 7th. I've just checked my watch, and it doesn't have a date on it. What date is today?
September 1st.
Well, that's just 6 days away, isn't it?
My God.
That's just 6 days away, and you're probably thinking to yourself, what am I going to do on September 7th? Well, now you know. You can either binge watch all 10 episodes of Tin Star on Sky Atlantic, or you can watch it one a week up until October, November. Something like that. What a choice.
Wow.
Amazing. So there you go. It's entirely up to you. And this week, as you've already heard, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, a lady who hasn't been in a six-hour meeting all day and thus hasn't had time to write an intro for her involving something to do with supernatural and shirtlessness. It's
Helen
O'Hara.
That was poetry, Chris.
Yeah.
Pure poetry.
Pure poetry.
They're still not shirtless. But okay.
Didn't someone send me a picture
of
this week?
That one picture, of that one scene.
That
in like
one scene.
Season two, probably.
So, oh, yeah, like you don't know.
Well,
like
it was only Sam, it wasn't Dean. So like,
okay. It's hard to tell them apart, quite frankly. Dean, his nipple actually slants a little bit to the left.
Ew, no.
It's true. He cannot balance an M&M on his nipples.
How?
He can't.
What is that a criteria for? Like, who judges people and their nipple
M&M balancing capability?
You do, Helen. That's what you do.
Yeah.
Really? No wonder I'm having such trouble getting a date.
Have you never gone to a gentleman's or ladies' strip joint where the gentlemen are gyrating on the stage? Have you never done this, Helen?
I have never done this, Chris.
And thrown M&Ms at them and gone, dance for me, monkey. You must balance it on your nipples.
No. I mean, Smarties are bust.
Next up is our quiet poddle. John Nugent, can you balance anything on your nipples? Is that inappropriate? Is that an inappropriate question for me
to
ask?
As your lawyer, John. As your lawyer.
Another colleague.
My mother listens to this.
Does she?
Yeah, she does. She's
Mrs.
a devoted
Nugent.
Listener.
Mrs. Nugent, is your boy capable of... How would your mum know?
I'd hope she wouldn't if I did, which I don't.
Oh, so you've just confessed.
How many listeners do you think know? Like, how many people do you think try it regularly?
Like, you've never tried to balance M&Ms on a man's
nipples. I can
nipples.
Honestly say.
I mean, they'd have to be quite erect, wouldn't they? They'd have to be sort of...
You'd have to
a certain temperature.
You'd have to ice cube them up first.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that keeps the M&Ms at an optimum temperature.
But they melt in the mouth, not on the nipple. What's happening? I don't understand.
God, we were a film podcast at one point.
At this point, Sky Atlantic are going, is there any way we can rescind the Tin Star sponsorship? And then people are going, no, it's fine. They've already heard about the Tin Star. But then the balancing of the M&Ms and the nipples and stuff. It's all gone wrong. Right, that wasn't this week's question.
Thank God.
All right, so this week's question comes from Stephanie Hitch. Stephanie Hitch. And it is in response to a bit of news that broke today. We can discuss it. We can discuss it later on, or we can discuss it now. And that news is that there is going to be an all-female version. This is in the works. Helen, you must know about this.
Yes, I do.
Of Lord of the Flies.
Yes.
And Twitter didn't seem to be terribly happy about this today. Do you want to tell people a little bit more about it, just in case? Let's fill in some context.
I mean, Lord of the Flies, the William Golding novel, which we all had to study for GCSE, I'm sure. And it is the story of English public school boys who get marooned on an island, and it all goes a bit savage.
It all goes a bit Lord of the Flies, doesn't it, really?
It does go a bit Lord of the Flies. That is correct. You've never
M&M
been...
nipple balancing left, right and centre is
They have
awful.
No M&Ms. It's terrible. They have to try
No wonder
coconuts.
They go mad.
Yeah. So so they're making, apparently, an all-female version of this. Now, this has actually impressively attracted criticism from both ends of the spectrum. So you have the usual sort of, oh, what are they going to make remake with women next? First Ghostbusters, now Lord of the Flies. What's after this? Die Hard.
Oh, you saw my tweet.
Yeah, which okay. The answer to which is, of course, sure, why not? But then you also get the criticism from the other side, which is it was a novel specifically satirizing the English public school boy and the way they were dehumanized before being put in charge of an empire. And maybe that wasn't a great idea. And therefore, to make it female-focused loses a huge part of its actual meaning and context. So basically, it was getting it in the neck from both sides. It's a film, apparently, with male screenwriters as well, which is slightly worrying. I think there is something in making a female Lord of the Flies in the sense of, you know, what happens to a group of women put in such a pressurized, difficult, terrifying situation. But I think you have to be careful to get the specifics of female behavior in that case. And, you know, men don't always manage to do that. And maybe male screenwriters are not the way to go.
Scott McGee.
Yeah.
Who can't even spell McGee right. And David Siegel. That's McGehee and not McGehee. And frankly, I'm worried because if you can't spell your own surname right, then you're not going to get a screenplay right.
I feel like that's some kind of hate crime, Chris, but okay.
And David Siegel are the guys that are going to write and direct it. They directed Bee Season and What Maisie Knew previously.
Which are not bad films.
No, not bad films at all. And
It's not necessarily a bad idea, I don't think. I'm not dismissing it out of hand. I think the original novel was very specific to English public school boys, but I don't think that means that there's no female equivalent that would work.
Yes.
And in fact, there have been a couple of sort of literary spins on it of one kind or another. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure how well it's going to do. I don't know.
Yes. We like to give everything the benefit of the doubt here, and I'm always slightly wary of the idea that men can't write women and women can't write men.
Sure.
Because if that were the case, then frankly, what would William Shakespeare have done, eh? 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 But it's certainly something that that has attracted opprobrium this week on Twitter. So, it has inspired a question, which is from Stephanie Hitch, at Stephanie Hitch. Ideas for gender swap films that would make infinitely more sense than Lord of the Flies.
Well, I was having a quick think about this just this minute.
Because this question came in just about 5 minutes ago.
I learned of this question.
Because of my shambolic preparations for the podcast.
Literally as we heard it. The first thing I thought was Ocean's 11, and then obviously I thought, well, that's already happening.
Ocean's 8.
Is due for release later this year, I think.
Next year. The longest post-production schedule for that film, I've never understood it. Anyway, go ahead.
It's just a huge amount of CGI.
Because the shot was 11 and they have to digitally remove 3. They got it completely wrong.
Yeah. I thought of The Expendables, but again, they're talking about The Expendables.
Terrible title.
Which is just the worst title.
That would kind of be amazing.
Can you think of a better title for the female Expendables?
I was going to say The Sexpendables, but...
No.
That would be a completely different film. Not one that would not get me sacked.
Okay. So, thanks for that, Chris.
That's
okay.
All good. No, I'm only kidding. That's a tough title.
Yeah.
That's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, I don't think you can improve on Expendables. That's
you can improve upon the Expendables
title.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what's a famous male ensemble cast that you could turn into a female cast?
The Thing.
The Thing, yes.
Yeah.
The
Thing.
Well, yeah.
I think there are a surprisingly small number of films set in convents and, you know, girls' schools and sort of other all-female environments. There have been some very good, some very bad.
Some coming as well later on this year. There are, yes.
The Nun, for one.
The Nun, yes. That's true. There's also that, oh my God, my mind's gone. The one with Aubrey Plaza. and Alison Brie.
Sure.
That's coming out as a comedy. Yeah. It's been out in the States, and everyone knows the name of it, and you don't need me to tell you the name of that film. There's Novitiate, which is a film coming out later in the year with Margaret Qualley. So, yeah, there seems to be a good time. A good time happening. The little hours.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Don't Google it, John.
don't inform yourself.
People don't come to the Empire Podcast for for information and facts. No, fake news.
Accuracy. But, the Little Hours is indeed the name of the thing.
Yeah. I knew it. Bang.
Yeah, of course you did. Bang
straight
on.
Away. Straight
amazing.
Away.
But I think there are... look, there has been a tendency in culture, not just film, to assume that men's stories are inherently more exciting or important than women's stories. And I think the women's stories which have worked and which have proved that wrong are the ones that drill into the particular ways that women interact in all female situations. And men can and have written that really well. One of the great classics of the genre is The House of Bernarda Alba by García Lorca, which is an incredible Spanish play, and which is one of the most scary things I've ever read. So there are great, great examples of it, and yet it is often terrible, like super bad, when men do it. So it's kind of, you need to fall somewhere between The House of Bernarda Alba and, you know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is also terrifying and female-focused, and you know, just the really bad, terrible St. Trinian sequels kind of a thing, which don't get it at all. Mm.
But yeah, it's, I don't think it's just a question of you take a classic film that has an all-male cast and just... switch up the genders. You have to have something that speaks to the female condition.
You do.
The way that women interact.
Yeah, you do. I agree with that. But I also think there is a place for remaking or repurposing existing titles, because men have dominated the culture so much for so long that every recognizable title pretty much is a male-focused one. And therefore, if you're looking for brand recognition and the things that drive sales, then you're almost always looking at something that is male-dominated. And this is the problem we have sort of in comic book adaptations as well. Almost all of the recognizable names are male names. So if you keep insisting, oh, it has to be an original story, why can't you do original stories? Why can't it be this? Why can't it be that? The reason is because so much of the cultural oxygen is already taken up. And unless we can sort of take some of that back, there is no physical space, there is no financial space for original female-focused ideas. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a little bit of appropriation of male-led stories and retooling and completely reshaping of those. And if you do it well, it can be brilliant. And if you do it badly, it's terrible. But if you do it well, it can be brilliant. And I think that's why this kind of this Ghostbusters stuff and the, you know, this kind of idea is coming up, because they're looking for names that will work that don't have to be male-led.
Do you remember the film Salt with Angelina Jolie?
Which was originally Edwin Salt, and it became
Edwina. That's right. It was originally, I think it was a Tom Cruise vehicle at one point, and the script was a male lead. And then they just gender swapped it and it became a female lead. And
I have to think they probably did a little bit more than that, though.
They might have. It might have been a bit more than changing the pronouns, but it can't have been that much. I don't feel a specifically male story that needed to, you know, a lot of work to be a female story. Ultimately, it's a spy story. It's an action movie. You know, Angelina Jolie was pretty convincing. It's a perfectly serviceable film. Yeah. And apart from the bit where she actually puts on makeup to become a man, that was quite strange. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
She pretends to be a male general and just looks like it.
Has for a large part just dimmed.
I saw it twice in a day and really enjoyed it.
You're kidding me. That's one of the films you've seen twice in a day.
Well, no, because I went to a press screening in the morning and then went to the premiere in the evening, because I got somebody in the office gave me tickets. I was like, yeah, all right. Angelina Jolie, cool.
Wow. You saw Salt twice.
Yeah, I was oversalted.
Can't have too much salt in your diet.
Yeah. Take that as a condiment.
I'm so sorry.
We'll pepper the rest of the podcast with terrible puns later on as well. Wow, that's amazing.
I've just blown your mind.
You have blown my mind. So the thing is interesting because the thing certainly does dwell a large part on relationships between men, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's about masculinity in the way that Lord of the Flies is, for example, or the way that Glengarry Glen Ross is. Now, that's an interesting one.
That could be amazing with women. Like, completely different, completely different.
Yeah.
But amazing.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking in Jason Reitman's live script read series, he did an all-black version of Reservoir Dogs, and I think he did an all-female version of Glengarry Glen Ross, which would have been pretty amazing to see.
Mm.
And Reservoir Dogs, again, is a film that is all blokes. It's all sausage all the time. So it would be interesting to swap that around and see if that changed anything. It changed the dynamics and changed the way the characters interacted.
It's not quite a film, but I'm a big fan of the graphic novel Why the Last Man,
yeah,
which imagines a world where all men die out apart from one guy.
And his monkey.
And his monkey, who is also male. And it's really fascinating and a really interesting exploration of gender dynamics and all this sort of thing. But if you flipped it and had all the women die out, I think it would be a completely different story. And I imagine everyone would just, you know, murder each other.
Yeah, probably
within the first few days.
I mean, the women do a fair amount of murdering.
There is plenty of it's plenty of violence in that one, but I think it's a really interesting sort of premise, and it's executed really well.
It's a great graphic novel.
I really hope they turn it into a film or a TV show at some point. Because
yeah,
so which one would you, if you hand on heart, if you had to see one, which one would it be? If you had to see, if you had to switch gender flip one movie, what would it be? Salt. Back to Tom Cruise.
No appropriation of our movie, that one movie that we have.
Hang on, you appropriated it first. Give it back.
I don't know. What's the most ridiculously, ludicrously macho movie? I know. Predator.
Right.
Predator.
Predator with seven
just
ladies.
Just women.
And
yeah.
the Predator's female as well.
Sure, it doesn't really matter, but sure.
But the Pildio Carrillo character is played by Arnold.
Yes.
And there's no mention.
Yeah, and is generally sort of folded up in a corner looking small and
just
scared.
Sort of,
yeah.
Whimpers.
This year goes hot, very hot. Jason Reitman did indeed do a live all-female reading of Glengarry Glen Ross. Here's this. I'll just run through the cast real quick. Robin Wright.
Yes.
As Ricky Roma.
Great cast.
That's pretty sweet. Catherine O'Hara as Shelley Le Machine Lafine.
Oh, nice.
Maria Bello as Dave Moss, who's the Ed Harris character.
Yeah.
George Aronoff, played by Alan Arkin in the movie. He had originally cast Allison Janney, but she had a dropout, and he replaced her with Melanie Linsky.
Okay.
That's good. Mm-hmm. I can see that. Mae Whitman played John Williamson, a.k.a. Kevin Spacey.
Right.
Go to lunch. Will you go to lunch? And then last but not least, Carla Gugino played two roles. She played the Alec Baldwin role, Blake, who's in the film but not the play. And she played James Link, the Jonathan Pryce role. He's the Mark that Ricky Roma. That's a hell of a cast.
That's a pretty good cast.
Hell
would
of a
watch.
Cast. I'd quite like to see Carla Gugino tracked in that speech. You know, it's like...
Yeah. ABC.
You know what you need to sell real estate? You need brass balls to sell real estate. all right, here we go. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, you can do so a variety of ways. You can email us. We're at podcast@empireonline.com. You can Facebook us as well. And you can Twitter us. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. Or chances are we won't see it. And hey, don't forget, we are going to be live at the London Podcast Festival on September 16th. The Saturday night slots. So if you fancy seeing in the midnight hour with the Empire team, then do come along to that. Tickets are available at www.kingsplace.co.uk, and you can buy a discount package as well that will allow you to see our show plus all sorts of other live podcasts as well. If you buy three or more shows, you get a discount of 15%, and you can't say fair than that. Okay, should we have a guest?
Let's
have a guest. Our guest this week has a movie which is out on Netflix right now. He is someone who is a bit of an Empire favourite. He's the director of films like You're Next and The Guest, which introduced us, of course, to our... Someone asked us, I apparently described Dan Stevens as our former spirit animal. Is that true, or is he still our spirit animal? Anyway, it introduced us to Dan Stevens in that movie. He was fantastic. He is, of course, Adam Wingard. His new movie is Death Note, which is based on a Japanese manga, and it can be seen right now on Netflix. Came out on Friday. It's a tale of a young man who discovers a notebook, and if you write someone's name in that notebook and the method of their death, they will meet that untimely demise. And as you can imagine, everything goes according to plan with his notebook, and it's all totally fine. Adam Wingard, of course, is now prepping his next movie, which is King Kong versus Godzilla, or Godzilla versus King Kong. I can never remember the title, which is actually something we discuss in the interview. Do enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of Death Note and The Guest and Blair Witch and You're Next and sundry other movies, Adam Wingard. How are you, sir?
I'm great.
So Death Note, which is a lot of fun, very violent. Mm-hmm. My God, it's violent. The opening death in Death Note left me under no illusions that you were not holding back in this one. Can you obviously you work with Netflix on this movie. It didn't start out that way. So can you talk me through how Netflix came aboard and what that means for you in terms of freedom as a director?
Sure, yeah. I mean, whenever the script was initially sent to me, it was from Warner Brothers, and that's who I originally signed on with. And the movie had been developed there for a number of years. At one point, Shane Black was attached to it, and Gus Van Sant, actually. I don't know how you go from Gus Van Sant to me, but there you go. You know?
I don't know how you think of Gus Van Sant for this project.
Yeah, I can't imagine what his version was, although, because I never read his script. I didn't read a lot of the early drafts. The producers never sent them to me, and I never really asked.
Okay.
But I did hear that his version was really wacky, which is not what you would expect, you know? But the movie had been in development there for quite some time, and they never cracked the code, and and from what I understand, that you know, some drafts even like didn't have Ryuk in it, and things like that. So I think it's gone through about every incarnation that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whenever I came on, the script that I read, it was interesting and it was very promising, but it still needed a lot of work. But I could see where we could go with it, and it was always a matter of, like, you know, if the studio's in agreement with the direction I want to go, then we're good to go.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was a rated R film, and that you know, all the things that the movie ended up being, you know, I knew that this were the direction we were going to go in. Uh-huh. And initially WB was 100% on board with that, and the budget that we were looking at too, which was relatively high for a rated R movie.
Yeah.
Especially a rated R movie about a magic notebook that kills people. but everything was going great over there. I mean, they were really passionate about the project. I think it was a very different thing, you know, for them. And so there was a lot of excitement at WB. And so I was developing the film, the script, with them for a better part of a year. You know, I signed on to it right before I did Blair Witch. Mm-hmm. And so I was working on it kind of concurrently when I was shooting Blair Witch. And so, you know, the first day that we were supposed to start official pre-production on it was going to be the right after I finished the sound mix for Blair Witch. So on Friday, you know, we wrapped the sound mix on Blair Witch, and I went out of town for the weekend to take a little breather.
Okay.
And everything was, you know, 100% in place. You know, everybody's telling me this is going to happen. You know, we had already had a line producer on. We had budgeted it out and everything. And, you know, I'm driving back from Joshua Tree, which is the usual place I go to hang out, you know, whenever I need to unwind. And I'm driving back, and I get a call from my manager early in the morning. And he's like, I can't remember what he said, but it was something kind of cryptic about the project. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He's like, oh, my God. He's like, am I going to have to be the one to tell you? And I was like, what? And then he's like, yeah, they're putting the movie in turnaround. And, you know, because at that point, that was a period where WB had kind of, they were having kind of a hard time. You know, they just had Pan come out.
Yeah.
And it got panned, and Heart of the Sea, and there's just kind of this string of, you know, kind of flops that had been coming out, and so, you know, like they kind of had stopped funding a lot of their, or they were getting rid of a lot of their mid-range budget stuff, and so we were just on the chopping block there. And so for me, I thought, okay, there's no way that we're going to make this movie then. You know, there's not going to be another studio that's going to raise their hand and say, yes, we want to make your expensive magic notebook movie that's very violent, you know, and a hard R. And, but, you know, as it turns out, you know, Netflix is was looking to be doing, you know, bigger budget movies.
Right, yeah.
That had an interesting kind of attitude to it. And, you know, so they just kind of raised their hand. Within a week, you know, we had this thing pretty much set up over there. It just happened really fast.
Wow. And,
so it was very shocking. I mean, we had interest from other studios, but a lot of them, you know, they wanted to do it for $10 or $15 million less, you know, and things like that. And the movie was already kind of budgeted to a T, you know, mm-hmm. so we knew that anything less than what we had already kind of put down was going to be a much lesser film. And but fortunately, Netflix, you know, did it for the budget that we had already kind of come up with. I think we actually did it for a little bit more over there. And you know, so it all kind of just fell into place.
So you start reading the script, and obviously you overhauled the script over time, mm-hmm. And being familiar on some level with the source material.
Mm-hmm.
How many changes did you make? How much did you change? I mean, it's
quite
difficult.
A bit. Yeah, I mean, you know, like from the get go, the script was already kind of set in Chicago, you know, one of the first changes I made was move it to Seattle because you know I really wanted the movie to have a really dreary, kind of rainy look to it. But, you know, whenever you're adapting something, you know, you always have to make kind of the decision. Are you doing sort of, you know, your version of it that's fully your own and, you know, you're kind of using inspiration, or are you doing something exact? And, you know, the second you take a story out of like Death Note out of Japan, which Death Note, you know, is about as Japanese as you get in every way, you know, it's one of those things where it just changes everything. And so, you know, early on, whenever I was coming to the realization that we were adapting something in a very abstract kind of way, I was a little scared because I knew there'd be a lot of blowback from, you know, hardcore Death Note fans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but for me, it was like, you know, I think that, you know, whenever, you know, if you're adapting something word for word exactly, you know, but you stray in just a few areas, that's almost, you know, more offensive, you know, to a lot of people, you know, like you always hear like, oh, the book was better than the movie kind of thing. And a lot of times when people say that, you know, they're really referring to the fact that the movie just left out one or two sequences in the book that they really liked.
Yeah.
And that changes the whole thing for them in a really negative way. And so in some ways it was kind of freeing to be like, okay, well, we're doing completely our own thing with this. And so that was always kind of the way to go from the get-go. And and it just evolved very naturally over time. You know, once I kind of let go of the fact that we were doing something completely different, then that kind of opened up the doors to kind of just respond to say, you know, how do we make this the best film possible?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm not going to probe too much, but on Kong versus Godzilla or is it Godzilla versus Kong?
What it'll be Godzilla versus Kong.
Godzilla
versus
Kong.
The original is King Kong versus Godzilla, so I guess we're splitting it up, you know.
There's a big fight for billion. It's like Lennon McCartney. Kong's going, I want top billion in this one.
Exactly.
Imagine the size of the trailers. My God, it's going to be something. But obviously that's going to be VFX. Is it Margie mocap? Is that how you do it? Or are you going to get a really big guy in a really big suit? I mean,
I think I'll probably follow in the footsteps of what they're doing with Godzilla 2 and in the last two films, you know. Obviously, like, I think especially Kong will probably evolve him just a bit, you know, because he's been on Skull Island for quite some time since the 1970s. So it'll be kind of interesting to see, you know, how he looks in this movie. And I have some pretty cool ideas of what I want to do with him. The process is interesting. I mean, like, I'm just now getting into it because we just literally finished Death Note about, like, you know, a couple days ago. And so I've had a couple, you know, overlap meetings, you know, where I've met with the writer and stuff. And we've had some preliminary discussions on based on the outline that's written for it right mm-hmm. now and kind of the directions to take it. And what I was going to say is that concurrently while we're writing the script, I'll be working on pre-viz, you know, animatics for the film. Mm-hmm. So we'll be kind of experimenting on what a fight between, for instance, Godzilla and Kong looks like in the movie while we're writing the script and hopefully influencing some of the directions that we go with the script, which will be cool. You know, like I look forward to that process.
So you're talking to Michael Daugherty. You're in
just a little bit. I've had a little bit of communication with him. He mentioned that he wanted me to, if I was going to be in Atlanta while they were shooting, that he wanted me to have a cameo as like a scientist or something like that, you know. I don't know if I'd have to shave my facial hair for that.
Scientists are cool, man. Scientists,
yeah,
scientists
exactly. I could be like the hippie scientist in the background, you know.
It's fine. How's your clipboard technique? Yeah. Are you good at writing stuff down?
Yeah, if I can just get little glasses I can push down the bottom of my nose and, you know. Yeah, so I've talked with him. I actually had dinner with Jordan, who directed, Kong. And, and he gave me kind of a rundown of some of the things to expect. And, and that was enlightening. And, because Jordan's coming from a very similar background to I am. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm coming off of, a lot more, kind of individual movie experience than he had. So at least I have some idea of what he's talking about. But, whenever you're working on a movie of this size, it's just, it's you're on a whole different level, and it's good to know kind of what to expect there.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, even at this early stage, you haven't really technically gone to prep, I guess, on the movie. Are you thinking about the human element of this movie when you have two titans like this, the size of the set pieces and...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always thinking about the perspective of it, because each film kind of takes a different route, in terms of the way you're experiencing, the monsters and things. So, the first thing I did once I even started talking to Legendary about the potential of doing this film is I went back and I watched every single Godzilla movie and most of the Kong films. And it was one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had in many years. I hadn't seen a lot of the Godzilla films since I was a kid.
Yeah.
And so it was really cool to be able to re-experience that and remember that, that the emotional stakes you have in these monsters is very real, especially when you're a kid. And that's one thing that I want to make sure that, that I'm kind of injecting into it. Not just the human story, because, that's going to be obviously a main focus and everything. Yeah. But, the main thing I really want to inject into it is kind of bring it back to that level where you're really empathizing with the monsters on a different level.
Fantastic. And when the project was first announced years ago, before you got involved on the Emperor podcast, we were going, how is that going to work? Godzilla is much bigger than Kong. He's going to use him as a toothpick. What's going to happen? But you're going to take care of that, right? I mean, Kong's bigger already. They've made him bigger.
He's bigger definitely now. And, they do imply in the last film that he's still growing.
He's a bear. So, he's a baby.
He's so a little there's a lot of stuff to figure out there. And that's why we're going to be doing pre-viz and stuff concurrently with the script, because it really is important to look at those characters and the way they interact with each other and understand that from the get-go. Mm.
So you're just to go back to the question I asked a few minutes ago, you're making, obviously Blair Witch is a sequel, Godzilla vs. Kong is a sequel, and this is an adaptation as well. But one thing you haven't really done, obviously you're involved with both VHS movies, quite heavily, is a sequel to your own work.
Mm-hmm.
I love The Guest, and The Guest is... set up particularly, I would say, for a sequel. Is that something that's ever crossed your mind? But
yeah, well, I mean, of all the films that I've done, I mean, The Guest would be the one that I would want to do a sequel for. Mm. But ultimately, it's not like any of those movies, especially like The Guest and Your Next, have ever been like so wildly successful, financially. I mean, both of them did well in their own right.
Yeah.
But to the point where it makes sense to make a sequel, it just hasn't. So that's why we've never done one.
Okay.
It's not because we wouldn't like to, but it just feels like it would be kind of a wank fest, it's just like, it feels like it's just for like a very small group of people, even though I think something like The Guest, you could kind of expand into something different.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, there's time for that, and, right now it's like, it's about really pushing ourselves forward. And, for me, it's, I feel like, the next few years are going to be about really, exploring, how big I can go with these movies. Mm. Obviously Godzilla and Kong is going to be huge. Ideally I'd like to do a Star Wars film, but beyond that, I think after this kind of run of things is over, then I'm going to go back and I have a couple movies that I want to do. I think I have about three movies, original movies that, that are real passion pieces that I want to get into after, either Godzilla or hopefully a Star Wars movie.
Well, that would be interesting. I mean, what's interesting as well is that Godzilla versus Kong is really the first out-and-out non-horror that you will have been involved with.
That's true.
I mean, as a huge horror fan.
It'll also be the first, PG-13 movie I've done, you know.
Oh, it's PG-13! Oh, come on, Adam!
Well, I assume it will be, you know. I doubt that they'll let me go hard R on that one.
You never know. Deadpool, look at Deadpool. That's the Kingsman there. These are R-rated films, you know. People being sliced in two and
exactly.
All sorts.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, they've just got the precedent of all those films being PG-13, so I'm sure I'll get kind of shoehorned into that, even though we haven't discussed that yet. But, you know, it'll be interesting. You know, kind of going at it that way. But, you know, yeah. I mean, monster movies are really, you know, like, you know, they need to be always on the edge of almost being R, you know. But ultimately, yeah. I think, you know, you want it to be able to appeal to kids too, you know.
Like, yeah.
And when I say that, I mean, coming from a guy who, whenever I was a kid, you know, my favorite movie was like, you know, Aliens and, you know, Terminator 2 and stuff like that.
You want the thrill of being able to sneak into the movie theater or the cinema, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you don't want to watch kiddie movies necessarily, you know? I mean, like, but even when you're watching a kid, like, you feel like, for instance, like the Godzilla films, this is what I kind of relearned as I was rewatching all those movies, is that when you're a kid and you're watching those, they feel like adult movies to you. You know, they feel very serious, and you take them very seriously. And it's because the movies have this kind of... you know, their own kind of vibe where they are, you know, really taking, you know, the monsters seriously. I mean, some of the Godzilla movies, they don't. I mean, some of them are kind of misses. But, you know, a lot of them, on almost every Godzilla movie, there's something great about it, you know, even the really bad ones.
Amazing. Adam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Adam Wingard. And now it is time to catapult straight into movie news. Hells bells.
Hi.
What's been happening?
Oh, so much news this week. I mean, the big one...
Genuinely, this sounds really sarcastic.
No, they're kind of... Well, there's a moderate amount of news, if I'm honest.
14 more Joker movies announced.
Oh, God. No, I mean, we've gone a week without a Joker announcement, so that's super good.
That's what he wants you to think.
He's lulling us into a full sense of security.
Or lolling.
No.
Lol.
No. Anyway, so really good news for 90s kids. Keanu Reeves and Winona Ryder are starring together in a romantic comedy called Destination Wedding.
No way.
They are.
No.
Yep. It's actually already apparently finished shooting, but they've only just sort of announced it.
This is huge.
But this is the first time they've kind of played lead roles together. I mean, they were in stuff together before. They were obviously, they played boyfriend and girlfriend in Bram Stoker's Dracula, which is just one of the great comedies.
I know where the bastard sleeps.
God bless him and his English accent. I'm doing air quotes for English. anyway, but I just think it's a delightful idea. So apparently they play miserable and unpleasant guests at a wedding at a fancy resort who are thrown together and sick and tired of everyone around them and somehow develop feelings for each other, but try to fight against them.
No.
Don't fight it, you two.
Just have attractive kissing.
Exactly. Attractive 90s kissing.
Is that the name of the movie?
Attractive 90s kissing. Yes, it should be. It is actually called Destination Wedding. So,
That's not a bad title, actually. Attractive 90s kissing is much better, but we'll go with it.
We didn't get them the note in time, I guess.
No, she'll get it in 2 years' time. No way, Sandra Bullock. Anyway, someone's going to get it in 2 years' time. Anyway.
Coley.
My word, that's gone up a sexy notch. What's next?
Slightly weird news. Lily Collins is joining Nicholas Hoult in the J.R.R. Tolkien biopic. So Nicholas Hoult plays the young J.R.R. Tolkien in this. I think it's called Tolkien.
And she plays Christopher Lee.
Yes.
Did I ever tell you I was cousins with J.R.? Yes, you did. Oh.
No, she plays Edith Bratt, who became his wife.
Spoiler!
I mean, like, this is not a spoiler. He lived, he died. They had lots of children together. This is not a spoiler, Chris. I refuse to accept it's a spoiler.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to Google it and make sure that you're telling the truth.
All right. So it's a sort of an, I don't know, I'm just very uncomfortable with a young, sexy Tolkien story. I'm just like, I have read some biographies of him. I realize that at some point he was young.
Yes.
I have read about
this. He must
have
been young at some
point,
right?
He was madly in love with his wife, and that's lovely and everything, but
Do you think it's going to be a lot of sex in this story?
I just hope not.
Maybe the JRR stands for Just Ruddy Roger.
No, please
no.
Oh
my God.
Yeah. So that's the thing that's happening.
Let's hope they don't split this film into three films. over 3 years.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I think
there's not enough story for one.
I will say that they're both great. We love them both. So let's hope that they're great together.
And they've both been on the podcast. Yes, they have.
Yes, they have. Yes.
So well done. Anyone who's been on the podcast gets a lifetime pass from us.
Yeah,
that's official. And you can you can take that to the bank.
So it's Tom Cruise, if you're listening,
lifetime pass. Do you just want to take a second to admire my willpower at not making a Lord of my Ring joke?
No, not anymore. I would have given you a moment after the show of admiration, but now you've squandered it on a throwaway joke.
Oh, the One Tower? No, okay.
No.
Anyway, let's move on. Let's move on.
I've got some news. Last week, we had the news that Ed Skrein would be playing Major Ben Damio in the Hellboy reboot. Mm-hmm. And it caused a bit of controversy because in the comics, he is a Japanese-American character. Ed Skrein is most definitely not Japanese or American. He's English. And he has pulled out the role in quite a surprising move. He posted on Twitter, really classy statement on Twitter, saying that it's clear that representing this character in a culturally accurate way holds significance for people. He felt it was important to honour and respect that, and he's decided to step down from the role so it can be cast appropriately. I mean, fair enough.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a really good move. I mean, I think it's a really, like, you know, the right move.
Yes.
When a sort of controversy like this erupts and you haven't already made the film. Mm. But I also think it's, you know, a strategically good move for the film and for him. I mean, he's coming off Deadpool. He did well in that as the villain. Mm-hmm. I think this is a, you know, supporting role in a movie, another R-rated movie that may or may not be a huge success. It will do his career far more damage to be hit by a scandal than it would do in benefit to play the role, ultimately.
I thought he must have weighed up the pros and cons of speaking out.
Yeah, I would imagine he spoke with the producers.
No, absolutely,
of course.
But he must have thought, is this going to, if I speak out, if I pull out this, if I release a statement, yes, I'll get kudos and it's fantastic and we applaud it. But will people think twice? You know that it can have a negative effect in Hollywood. Will people go, could this affect my career?
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and I'm glad, and absolute kudos to him for going ahead and having the balls to do this. Because we reacted, like, last week's podcast, I remember very strongly, you going, oh, Ed Skrein's been cast as this character. Went, oh, that's good, we like Ed Skrein. And then you go, well, the character's Japanese, and then we went, oh, well, this, we're not sure about that.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic that he's grabbed the bull by the horns and done that. And Mike Mignola, who's the creator of Hellboy, thanked him in a public statement, which, again, it's interesting because I assumed that Mike Mignola was very much involved with this movie. But we wish Hellboy all the best. We wish Ed Skrein all the best. He's, again, someone who was on the podcast, Liverpool fan, lifetime pass. And it's really, really cool. But I saw Chloe Bennett today. I saw a story with Chloe Bennett, who's in Masters of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
And she is, in response to this, has given a very interesting interview as well, where she basically accuses Hollywood of being very racist, and her name is Chloe Wang, and she had to change her name in order to get roles.
And it helped.
It helped.
Mm. That's the sad part. Yeah.
Which is intriguing. So where do they go from here, I guess?
I mean, there are a lot of very, very talented Asian and Asian American actors in Hollywood. I don't think they should have problems filling that role.
Yep.
I really don't. So, yeah, best of luck with it.
Yeah, he's hoping this whole Ed Skrein publicity is a bit of a turning point for Hollywood, and actors and casting agents and producers and directors are just a little bit more aware of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anything else?
A couple of other quick stories. Ben Affleck is apparently setting up his next directing film, or at least he's in early talks to call the shots on Red Platoon, which is based on a memoir by Clinton Ramesha about his experiences during the Battle of Kamdesh in Afghanistan in October of 2009. So it sounds like it has, you know, I don't know, on paper it would have comparisons to something like Lone Survivor. Not that I'm saying it was a similar situation in terms of there being a lone survivor, but in terms of facing vastly superior numbers in a pre-dawn raid. So there was a Congressional Medal of Honor involved. If you want to read more about the circumstances, there's a bit more in our story, but I don't want to spoil everything. Apparently, if Affleck takes the job, he's looking at Casey Affleck for the lead role, which would be the second time they've teamed up after Gone Baby Gone.
Amazing. He can, you know, he's still got his number. I mean,
well, it's under A. He doesn't have to look that far.
That's true. It's the first in his Rolodex.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that is apparently a thing that may or may not happen. We shall see. But one to keep an eye on.
That's excellent news. As indeed, I think we talked about this last week. We talked about the return of Alan Partridge in the League of Gentlemen last week, I believe, on the show. But we didn't talk about, I don't think it was actually announced, return of Fleabag.
Yes.
Fleabag is given the second series. Excellent. After rubbing a cheese into the face of Tony Ayres, head of commissioning at the BBC. Phoebe Waller-Bridge has got a second series. Amazing. Excellent. And a whole new adventure. We don't know much about it, but I'm excited.
Couldn't be happier. In some more TV news, we got the first trailer for Black Mirror Season 4 this week, which is very exciting. Only a 30-second or so trailer. It just gave us some little flashes from each episode and the episode titles. Mm. So the episode titles are Archangel, Black Museum,
yes,
Crocodile,
ooh,
Hang the DJ,
ooh,
Metalhead,
yes,
and USS Callister. And USS Callister is the most intriguing of these six so far. If you see from the trailer, it's essentially a massive Star Trek pastiche.
Yeah, it has Jesse Plemons as Captain Kirk, let's be honest.
I'm very excited about this. I actually spoke to Charlie Brooker for the next issue of Empire, and he has told me some very exciting things, none of which I am at liberty to say.
Well, darn.
You'll have to buy the next issue of Empire.
I guess I will.
I get mine for free, Helen.
Oh, I do too. just today, as we record this, the full BFI London Film Festival timetable was announced, which is worth a look if you're anywhere near London. I mean, otherwise, it's, you know, it might be too far for you to come.
That's London, England.
That's London, England, not London, Ontario.
No.
We already knew that Andy Serkis's Breathe, his directorial feature debut, I think, is going to be opening the film. Yes. Martin McDonagh's Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, what a catchy title, is closing. And Emma Stone and Steve Carell's Battle of the Sexes is in there in the middle. We now know we're also getting Paddy Considine's Journeyman, Todd Haynes' Wonderstroke, Alexander Payne's Downsizing, which debuted this week at Venice and is getting a lot of excitement.
It did.
Call Me By Your Name, How to Talk to Girls at Parties from Cameron... John Cameron Mitchell. I mean, Chris, I could see that one coming. Killing of a Sacred Deer from the team that brought us The Lobster. Thank you. Richard Linklater, The Shape of Water from Guillermo del Toro. Aww. And The Florida Project from Sean Baker. So super exciting lineup. And yeah, can't wait to see more.
That's a hell of a lineup.
We should also probably mention that Noah Baumbach's The Meyerowitz Stories is debuting in an Empire Gala. Which is very, very exciting.
Oh, yeah, we should mention that.
since we're checking some money out of them, we should probably...
The Empire Gala.
Yeah.
There we go. That is probably the most exciting of all the films.
It is the most... Well, it is, because it's Adam Sandler in a serious drama.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's good at those.
And Ben Stiller.
Is. Yeah, but he does those all the time. Yeah. Adam Sandler, that's where it's at.
Yeah.
Very, very excited about that. And go to the internet for more information. That's www.theinternet.com. .net. I will just say as well that this week, a few weeks ago, we lost a horror master in George A. Romero, and this week we lost another in Toby Hooper, who passed away at the age of 74. And if you haven't seen The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, then you're missing out on one of the truly great horror films. He was a director who I think, probably even by his own admission, I never had a chance to talk to him, but I imagine... Having read interviews with him over the years and knowing people who've interviewed him, by his own admission, he probably would have said that his career was hit and miss. But it was a career that nevertheless had, for me, three of the all-time great horror, I was going to say films, but one of them's a TV miniseries, so we'll get around that. So there's Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
He also directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, which isn't a great film, but it is a lot of fun. And if you want to see Dennis Hopper doing a dueling chainsaw... fight.
And who doesn't?
And going completely off the deep end as only Dennis Hopper could, then check out Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just an utterly terrifying film. Really primal, really brutal, really lo-fi. He also officially directed Poltergeist. And I know there's obviously been a lot of discussion about Steven Spielberg's role in that movie, but Toby Hooper was there. He's the guy who directed the film. And that as that shipped me up as a kid and has continued to do so as an adult. And of course, he is the guy responsible for two of the great images in horror from Salem's Lot, the adaptation of Stephen King's great vampire novel, little vampire kid tapping at your window, floating in midair, and the appearance of Mr. Barlow in the prison with his full Nosferatu makeup. So, yeah, a director capable of true greatness, and very, very sad indeed to see him go. Tobe Hooper, who died this week. Okay, time for one final message from our sponsors, Sky Atlantic, and their new show, Tin Star, starring Tim Roth and Christina Hendricks, coming to you September 7th. And the word doesn't come from us this week. It comes from the star of the show himself, Tim Roth, who plays British expat cop Jim Worth, who is now the sheriff of a small town, Little Big Bear. And bad things happen to him, but you know what? He happens back to the bad things. So here he is, with just a few quotes about the show to set things in context. Here's Tim Roth. Enjoy.
There was a madness to it that I was interested in. It wasn't his job was not interesting to me. The insanity of the man and the craziness and the wildness of the character and how that and his relationships with the people around him, that was interesting. I did not know where it was going, and that's an attractive proposition.
That was Tim Roth. And just as a reminder, Tin Star is available on Sky Atlantic from September 7th. You can watch all 10 episodes at once if that is your wont, or you can watch it on a weekly basis. Entirely up to you. And so ends the message from our sponsors. And we're going to go straight into our second and final guest this week. He is a British acting legend. He is a British acting institution. He has been in all sorts of amazing films over the years, from things like Shaun of the Dead to Hot Fuzz, The World's End, and other films not directed by Edgar Wright. One of those comes up this week. It is The Limehouse Golem, in which he plays an intrepid British police inspector trying to stop the murders of the infamous Limehouse Golem. He is, of course, Bill Nighy, and he was talking to you, John, wasn't he?
Yes, he was talking to me.
There you go. Bill Nighy, John Nugent, that's all you need to know. Enjoy.
We're delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast Bill Nighy. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you. Good to be here.
Great. We are here to talk about The Limehouse Golem, which is based on a book by Peter Ackroyd, I believe.
That's correct.
Are you familiar with that book?
I am now, having made the film. And in fact, I knew of the book, but I'd never read it. It's called Dan Leno and The Limehouse Golem.
Right.
And Peter Ackroyd is a wonderful writer, and I hope we've done him justice.
Yeah, and it's a sort of a precursor to Jack the Ripper, I suppose. It's like a Victorian murder mystery.
Yeah, it's 1880. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of fog. It's a wonderful script by Jane Goldman, and it's a sensational kind of collection of people who've made the movie. And it's a thriller, and it's romantic, hopefully. And I play Detective Superintendent John Kildare of Scotland Yard. It's a long time since I've said that. And I always get a bang out of saying that. I've waited a long time to be a detective.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's an interesting character, isn't he, Kildare? He's a sort of intriguing figure. It's all sort of mixed of fiction and fact, but I'm assuming he's a fictional character.
Yeah, he's a fictional character who is not majorly featured in the book, right, but he's been enlarged for the movie for purposes of the film. The kind of fabulous thing about the story is that all the suspects in the murder mystery are, you know, internationally famous figures,
yes,
or at least famous figures. So that you do get that kind of intriguing mix of what's real and what's not.
Yeah, it's quite a thrill to see Karl Marx sawing someone's head off. I mean, that's something you see in every film.
No, quite. Now, it's quite an unusual film, although it is, you know, it is, a genre film, yes, and you would think of things like From Hell, the Johnny Depp movie, or rather, I would think would be a kind of a companion piece. But it is kind of unexpected, and you do see some things you won't have seen before.
With Kildare, was this a character that you sketched out a sort of history and a backstory? Because there's an interesting line where one character says he's not the marrying kind, which says so much, I suppose.
Yes. No, he's gay at a time when it's not you know, it's not desirable in terms of public life or any kind of life. You know, it was in those dark days when it was, it could destroy your life. So, yes, that's an interesting element of the character.
Yeah. We're treated to some fairly magnificent Bill Nighy costumes in this film as well. I mean, you're known for being quite a dapper gentleman. Were you quite at home in that sort of Victorian cravat? And
it's a little early for me, to tell you the gods. It's I only really get interested in the late 40s.
Okay.
I know to say that because I just made a film called Their Finest, which was set in 1940, and I discovered that clothes only really got good in about 1946.
Okay.
That's when everything sort of started to flow.
Right.
Everything got loose and trousers got bigger. and, you know, it just got more elegant. And all the women look very chic.
Yes.
But Victorian England's, I managed to avoid the top hat. That's the great danger. And facial hair, obviously, which is not desirable.
It's not for you, then, a Victorian sideburn or anything like that?
No, I can't bear those Victorian sideburns, or even, you know, 1950s sideburns, or any sideburns, particularly. But facial hair really is to be avoided, because nearly always you have to stick it on. And having to wear false beards or sideburns is, I can't tell you how unpleasant it is. It's an under-regarded source of grief. It makes you want to tear your flesh off.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it just because it's hot under the studio lights?
Well, it's also stuck to you with industrial adhesive, which is enough to knock you out. There's nothing pleasant about it.
Fair enough. Just on Their Finest, I think Edgar Wright tweeted just the other day that this, particularly the last scene where you do a sort of triple take and a pause, he tweeted that was peak Nighy. It did seem like that part was sort of written for you. It was such a perfectly pitched Nighy role.
Well, thank you. They were looking for someone to play a chronically self-absorbed, pompous actor in his declining years, and they came to me. So thank you for that. No, it wasn't written. It wasn't written for me. In fact, I don't believe. But thank you for saying so. Yeah, and I'm pleased that Edgar should say that. I've worked with Edgar a couple of times, and he's a remarkable man.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're in. I think you're one of the few actors to be in every Cornetto film.
I am in all three of the Cornetto trilogy.
Yeah. Just going back through your CV, I mean, we'll go through every one bit by bit. And we've only got 20 minutes.
How long we got? Yeah.
Red Nose Day, actually, that was quite a joy for a lot of people to see you return to that character.
Yeah, it was fun, you know, to see everybody. We hadn't all been in the same room for whatever it is, 14 years.
Yeah.
And it was really nice to see everyone, and everyone was in pretty good shape, and you know, and they've all had kind of extraordinary things happen to them since we made the film, and nobody knew, you know, everybody. I mean, I kind of thought it might be a popular film because the script was very good, and because of the cast, and because of Richard Curtis, obviously, but nobody, I think, was prepared for the way in which it's entered the language, you know, and it's become a kind of an institution.
Mm.
But the good news was I could still get into the trousers, which was, you know.
Was it the same pair of trousers?
No, but they were of similar dimensions.
Okay.
And I had to wear some extraordinary shoes.
I saw those shoes, yeah. They were sort of, was it like sparkling green?
They were like furniture. They were like something you'd sit on. Or, I don't know, put your dog in. But they were auctioned, I think, afterwards. So somebody is now walking around in those shoes.
Wow. And we learn in that short film that that Mac has shagged at least one of the Kardashians. Did you get any indication which one?
Well, I don't. To tell you the God's honest truth, I had to ask. I mean, I kind of know who they are. I have no idea. You know, I just don't. I've never watched one. Only by accident have I ever watched 1 second of what might be described as reality TV. I mean, I made a rule the minute I got to hear about it that it would never enter my life or my consciousness. So unless there's a sort of accident and I can't find the remote.
Yeah.
And it's no disrespect to any of the people involved. It's just, I just know it's not for me.
Yeah.
I won't be able to survive it. It's not entirely, you know, it's not their fault. It's me. I won't be able to, you know, it would be overwhelming for me.
Yes. So the whole I don't know, abstract concept.
Well, it was I just trust that Richard knows what he's doing. I mean, I had no, I don't know which, who they. I know they're a family.
Yeah,
that's all I know.
Well, I mean, he got a big laugh, so I think the joke landed.
Good. That's all I. Yeah. Honestly, that's all I care about.
Yeah, we did see you sort of. In a manner of speaking, in the recent Pirates of the Caribbean film, I don't know if you've seen
it. I haven't seen it, and I've a couple of people have come up and said and told me that I didn't know anything about it until about a week ago. I think a cab driver told me. He said that are you doing the next one? Because I said no, I didn't know there was a next one. And then he said, well, you were in the last one.
Yeah,
I said no, I wasn't. He said, well, you were. So that's the last, that's the all I know. You know, you probably know more about it than I do.
So is this a confusing thing to be in a film that you didn't realise you were in?
Well, I'm presuming it's a brief glimpse.
It's a post-credits scene, so they see you sort of the shadow of Davy Jones.
Oh, I see.
But you're not expecting to be in Pirates of the Caribbean 6 or whatever.
Is it 6?
This was the last one, was 5, yeah.
Wow.
So.
I'd love to be in, I'd be there like a shot, but I've not been approached.
Okay, interesting. I did want to ask you very briefly, as we're speaking, it's been a few days since the new Doctor Who was revealed. According to the internet, you turned the role down back in the day.
There you go with the internet. What are we going to do with the internet?
Yeah.
Even if it were true, I wouldn't tell you.
Okay.
It's a rule.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So, but people put stuff on the internet. There's all kinds of stuff on the internet. My sister looks at the internet. I don't have a computer. I've never owned a computer. I have a smartphone, but I very rarely enter that world unless it's a football matter that I have to know about.
Yes, that's quite important.
Usually with, if somebody's, anyway. But I've been, I'm often, not often, but not infrequently credited with being in things I'm not in.
Okay. You have such a, wide and illustrious CV. I was fascinated to see you were in Destiny, video game, as the speaker.
I am, yeah, the speaker,
What was your experience like that? Because,
it's great.
That must be quite a different experience for an actor.
Yeah, it's great. I'm pleased to be in it. And people, young people are impressed that I'm in it. And the thing I like about it is that if you only get to meet me if you're doing any good.
Right, right.
As far as I understand, I've never watched the game. I've never seen the game.
Yeah.
But
an achievement to be unlocked, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to, you kind of have to work hard to get to me, which is obviously glamorous. but I like genre, and I like, generally speaking, I like sci-fi. I like, kind of hip sci-fi, obviously, and I would count Destiny in there, in that sort of general area. So it's cool to be in that.
You do hear from some actors that the experience of recording dialogue for a video game can be quite arduous.
It can be, because they have specific requirements, and you can. I mean, arduous. Yeah, I mean, it can be, it's not digging holes in the street.
Sure.
But it can be, it can be quite, it needs to be quite precise sometimes. So you might have to do quite a few takes to get exactly what they want, because they have very, very clear ideas. They often have because it's genre and there are certain kind of guidelines or certain precedents for things, including character, they can have very sort of exacting, very particular ideas about what they want, what they require.
But it's not digging a hole in the street, I suppose.
But it's not digging holes in the street, John. Let's face it, like men.
Yes.
I always think, whenever I start saying acting's hard, which it is really hard, and actually I think it's harder than digging holes in the street. But now I've said it. But you always feel you should qualify it in some way by saying, come on,
Yeah.
Because, any actor who's got a job is already fortunate. So, it doesn't mean to say it's a walk in the park. I mean, it can be quite hard. But animations or video games are not the hardest part of being an actor.
Yeah. I did read somewhere that you don't watch yourself
No.
in your own films. Why is that?
Well, would you like to watch yourself? Heavens, a couple of
no.
hours.
No.
35 feet high. Exactly. I mean, it, who, you know, I mean, you know, unless I tried it when I was very first on television, and it was so unpleasant that I decided that if I was going to be an actor, and I couldn't, you know, that would have to be, I'd have to remove that element, because I have to, you know, I have to go to work again in a minute.
Yeah.
So I don't need, you know, hard information that all my worst fears are confirmed, you know, because that's how I perceive it. I'm prepared to, I've become kind of comfortable. Well, I don't know about comfortable. Yeah, I've become comfortable with the disparity between what I might feel and what other people, how other people view it.
Right.
I used to think they were sort of being polite, somewhere between being polite and mad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or that it was a conspiracy, or, you know, I can do that. But now I understand that I'm not necessarily the best judge.
But do you not feel you're sort of denying yourself some great films? I mean, you've been in some very good films, Bill.
Yeah, but the price is too high.
Okay.
And thank you for saying that. But the price is too high. And I was there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I know what happened, kind of
thing. Okay.
And I know the other people in it, and I know the script was good, because I was, you know, I chose it. And therefore, I have all the information I need. And I'm proud to be in those films. I don't need to have sat there and watched myself all the way through, or any of the way through.
Fair enough. I should ask, this is partly because my mother would hate me if I never asked this question, but will there be a third best exotic marigold hotel?
I think Judy Dench was asked this question, and she said, well, they better hurry up. So, I mean, I've heard nothing. Tell your mother from me.
Okay.
That what's your mother's name?
Anna.
Hey, Anna. I don't have any hard information about this, Anna.
Okay.
But if I do, obviously you're going to be one of the first to know.
Okay, she'll be thrilled.
Good.
We'll set up a line of communication for
her.
Yeah.
We can work that out.
I think I'm almost out of time, but just finally, last time you were on the podcast, you spoke to my colleagues about getting in the wrong taxi and becoming the president of the Crystal Palace Ladies Football Club.
I've become less comfortable with the word lady.
Okay.
I like women's better.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no disrespect to you. Sure. I mean, it is often referred to in that way. But I'm now, I just reminded myself I no longer want to use that word.
Well, I beg your pardon.
It's nothing to do with you, John. It's nothing to do with you. I've just touched his knee.
That's fine.
I just touched his knee, and now we're both in very serious trouble. As an uptight, averagely uptight Englishman, we're now really, I don't know what came over me.
Oh, I won't wash that knee ever again.
I was trying to reassure him. That's all it was, ladies and gentlemen. But I touched his knee.
So
anyway,
the official title is Crystal Palace Women's Football Club. Is that
right? What I'm calling it.
Okay.
And they are also referred to as the Invincibles.
Right.
Because if you ask me how many games they lost the season before last, which is when they gained this title, I will tell you they lost no games whatsoever.
Wow.
They drew twice.
Okay.
And they won all the others.
That's
you
very
can
impressive.
Imagine a football team doing.
And can we attribute this success to your presidential regime?
Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with me whatsoever. They did it all by themselves. If anything, I impeded them. If anything, they were thinking, oh, God, we've got to do all this, and now we've got this lame president thing. I've never been a president of anything, and they've never, I don't think, had a president.
Right.
The man who recruited me, satisfyingly, always refers to me as El Presidente, which obviously I like very much.
Yeah, but your presidential duties don't extend beyond, it's a ceremonial role, presumably.
It's a ceremony. I'm creating the role.
Okay. You make
so,
it work.
So we have to see, we'll see how we go as we go along. But, you know, I at the moment, yes, it is a kind of, it's a figurehead.
Okay.
Is the word we might use.
Well, best of luck to you and the women, not ladies, of Crystal Palace.
Thank you very much indeed.
Bill Nighy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so that was Bill Nighy. John, good guy. I walked past him as a newsagent and I just got that good guy vibe.
Yeah, he's definitely a good guy. He's the kind of guy I'd like to hang out with. He was also very kind enough to leave a little message to my mum, as you will have heard.
Oh, sort of died at the beginning.
Yeah. This is a podcast for Mrs. Nugent.
Similarly, did he ask her whether you can balance M&Ms on your nipples?
That didn't come up, actually. That didn't. It was on the tip of my tongue. It was on the tip of my tongue.
Well, you're doing it wrong. Okay, so let's talk about the film, The Limehouse Golem. And so this is about Andy Serkis, right?
No, different. Not Golem.
All right,
Golem.
Okay. Got it completely wrong. Yeah. What's it about? Tell me things.
This is about, it's based on the book by Peter Ackroyd, Dan Leno and the Limehouse Golem.
Oh, okay.
So a series of ritualistic killings in Victorian London. It's a sort of precursor to the Jack the Ripper murders.
Okay.
And the police parachute in Inspector Kildare, played by the fabulously dapper Bill Nighy, to investigate these crimes. Kildare is quite an interesting character. It's very heavily implied that he's gay at a time when you can't be gay, obviously. And so he's being used as a sort of scapegoat for unsolvable murders. Mm-hmm. On his investigations, he comes across some music hall stars. So there's Dan Leno, who's played by Douglas Booth. His protege in the music halls, Elizabeth, who's played by Olivia Cook. And he starts to sort of unravel the story behind these murders. So that's basically it. I mean, it's a very cookie-cutter portrayal of Victorian London. There's, you know, lots of fog and gothic costumes and graphic murders. I mean, really graphic murders, actually, surprisingly so. If you if you really like watching women murdered in extremely graphic ways, then I guess this is the movie for you, but you should probably, you know, not like that.
Yeah, maybe think about your life.
Maybe reconsider. Not liking that.
Yeah.
So this is a film aimed at the Limehouse Golem, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, it's pretty explicit in a way that perhaps it didn't need to be.
Yeah,
it's a strange film because it portrays that there's about three suspects, major suspects throughout the film, and each of them are real life figures. So there's music hall legend Dan Leno, as I mentioned, who is a real life music hall star. There's a failed playwright, John Cree, played by Sam Reed. Mm-hmm. And then there's Karl Marx, as in the actual Karl Marx. And we witness these murders sort of as if they were done by the suspects in a sort of hypothetical fantasy. So you have this really strange sequence of Karl Marx sawing a woman's head off, which is not, you know, it's quite an unusual thing to see the father of communism portrayed as a murderer. Now, not
capitalists will love it.
Yeah, maybe. You know, not to give any spoilers away, but the actual killer is signposted from about the fifth minute, so you already know who's done it in what is purportedly a whodunit. And I spent the entire film just sort of with my head in my hands, thinking, I know what happens. I've already figured it out. You've telegraphed it literally from the first flashback. So when it comes to what is supposedly the big reveal, there is nothing to reveal, and it's infuriating. It's absolutely infuriating. I feel like they think they're being very clever, and they're really not. It's a real shame because there is a really good cast. I think Bill Nighy is very dependably great. He's not playing up to his, you know, usual sort of Bill Nighy character, as it were. He's
debonair cat.
Yeah, he's a lot bit more serious and subdued.
Suave.
And he's very good for that. Olivia Cook is very good as well. She's carries a lot of the film on her shoulders, and you know, she gives a really game performance. And Douglas Booth plays this very sort of camp Victorian showman, and he's brilliant, but it doesn't quite come together. It feels a little bit predictable. It feels a little bit like a sort of Jack the Ripper ripoff, and I don't know. I just find it, if you know who done it in a whodunit, then fundamentally it's flawed. So unfortunately, we gave this one 2 stars.
Yeah, shame.
Yeah.
2 stars then for the Limehouse Golem. But you know what? I gave your Bill Nighy interview 4 stars.
Thank you. What did I miss on the 5th star?
It was the nipple thing.
I should have just... You should have asked him the nipple question.
You should
Why?
Have gone in. Just balancing a green one on this one and then balancing a... Do they do blue M&Ms?
Oh, Chris, yes, you should know
yes,
this.
They don't.
Come on.
No,
come
they
on.
Don't. They, do they? I just eat them. I don't look at the colours. Right, so 2 stars down for the Limehouse Golem. I apologise for this week's inadvertent riff. Stratton, that's a film that's coming out.
It is a film that's coming out. It's based on a series of novels about a British spy, a member of the Special Boat Service, which is more commando unit, but they work very closely with MI6, and therefore they actually, they kind of do a lot of the action stuff that James Bond dozen films in real life.
Right. Okay.
Right. They're kind of the naval equivalent of the SAS. They're the equivalent of the US Navy SEAL, with whom they often work. And the series of books was written by Duncan Faulkner about the service. So John Stratton's is the hero of all of them. He's played here by Dominic Cooper, and he's basically assigned to track down a former Russian agent played by Thomas Kretschmann. who's planning an international terror attack against London. I know. So that's kind of the basic setup. It's kind of a bit of a team movie. You start off with Stratton's best mate, who's played by Tyler Hoechlin, who was Superman recently in Supergirl. Mm-hmm. Getting killed during a raid that goes wrong because of this Russian spy. Sorry, it's a spoiler, but it's literally the first 5 minutes.
J.R. Tolkien, now this. You just won't stop, wouldn't you?
Sorry. He has to team up with another US SEAL who may or may not be quite as dependable, as well as his own MI6 and SBS unit to try and stop this new terror threat. Now, it's all directed by Simon West, who, of course, made Con Air. It doesn't live up to those standards because...
Very few films do.
What can. But you know what? I didn't mind it. I think it's quite fun. There's Gemma Chan's in there as the sort of tech wizard. You've got Tom Felton as her sort of partner on the tech side of things. Connie Nielsen plays the SBS boss, kind of MI6 boss. So it's a really good cast. It's just a little bit too... It tries
generic.
Not to be... No, well, a little bit. But it tries not to be Bond by keeping things a little bit more dialed back and a little bit more reined in. And it's a little bit too dialed back and reined in at times. So then when the action scenes happen, they don't feel as kind of natural.
Okay.
We didn't... Love this one. We give it 2. I'd maybe be a little bit warmer towards it than that, but it's a 2-star film.
Can I just clarify real quickly?
Sure.
I laughed at the mention of Thomas Kretschmann's name. It wasn't because I think he's a bad actor. I think he's a good actor. I was laughing
at him being cast as another,
a bad guy.
Yeah.
Yes, because it shows a lack of imagination.
Yeah.
But I will say Henry Cavill was meant to play this role and dropped out quite late in the day. How's Dominic Cooper in this? Because I like Dominic Cooper a lot as an actor. I'm not sure I see him as a hard-edged killing machine.
I mean, it's not that he's bad in the action scenes. He's good in them. I just think, like I say, I think he's above all too dialed back and a little bit internal. And you maybe need a little bit of the flash of Bond for this to work. So there's some quite nice notes. You know, he was basically raised by Derek Jacobi's character and they sort of trade little banter over fishing boats and things like that. So there's some nice notes about it, but he doesn't quite carry it the way you wish he would and the way he can in other things.
How much better would it have been had he just been raised by Derek Jacobi?
that would be pretty cool too. Yeah.
So there you go. 2 stars for Stratton. Tries hard, but ultimately is just a load of SBS. What? All right, so next up we have God's Own Country, which is a film that I know that Empire, we have a feature in this month's edition with the director Francis Lee talking about what inspired him to make the movie. It's a movie that we've gone gaga for. Why have we gone gaga for it, Helen?
Because it's really good, Chris. I mean, basically. So we're up in rural Yorkshire, the sort of protagonist, I guess, is Johnny, who's played by Josh O'Connor, who's the son of a sheep farmer, is himself, you know, stepping into that role. His dad's getting on, his dad's getting sort of slower and sicker, and he's kind of stepping up to kind of make up the difference. And has sort of small expectations of life, I guess, when we meet him. You know, he's just going, he works, he drinks, he goes to sleep, he wakes up, probably throws up and, you know, gets back to it. There's not much more to his life than that. Sort of wordless sex and sort of meaningless kind of hookups like that. And then they hire a new farmhand who kind of breaks into his shell, I guess, and breaks something open inside him. And there's a kind of a tenderness and a connection, I guess, between them that sort of, it's kind of transcendent, actually. It's a gorgeous kind of relationship movie. I mean, and that's what's drawn all these very, very flip and very easy comparisons to Brokeback Mountain, which have kind of been the one-line review of this film the whole way through. But it is that sort of tentative tentative relationship between two guys who are afraid to let themselves show it, I guess. And yeah, beautifully, beautifully performed, gorgeously shot and directed, and really kind of a really, an incredibly confident debut, but also just a beautiful, beautiful love story.
Fantastic. And so this one is a four-star.
Four-star film.
4 stars then for God's Own Country. And spoiler alert, 4 stars also for Patty Cakes.
Yeah, which is quite a lot of fun, actually. So we've got Danielle McDonald, who is Australian, although I wouldn't have guessed because her New Jersey accent is, to my untutored ear, pretty darn convincing. She plays a wannabe rapper who lives in New Jersey and has a very tough existence. Her mum is a kind of party girl who's never kind of gotten on with her life. Her grandmother, played by Kathy Moriarty, is very sick, and they don't have proper health insurance, so they're being chased for money for her. She only has a small a part-time job, and she can't find a permanent position that would pay her enough to kind of cover all of this. And she and her best friend Jerry are dream of kind of getting out and making it as a rap duo. Called Thick and Thin, because Jerry, played by Siddharth Dhananjay, is thin and she is quite large. That isn't kind of working for them until they hook up with a anarchist punk, who goes by the name Bastard the Antichrist.
Oh my god.
That he's played by Mamadou Afi, who played Grandmaster Flash in The Get Down.
Okay,
and he's kind of, I loved him out. He's a kind of zen, wise, warm, very silent figure who goes completely nuts in his music. It's great. But the real breakout of this is Danielle McDonald as Patty herself, because she is just, she's a really talented rapper, but she just doesn't look like she's a really talented rapper, and it sort of has to kind of overcome everyone's expectations and to some extent her own to kind of get anywhere in life. Without giving anything away, the sort of the way this film pays off, I think, is one of the best conclusions in years. I think it's just beautifully brings together all the things that have happened during the film. There are times when this film lags a little bit and drags a tiny bit in the middle section, but the way they bring it all together at the end is spot on. It's really, really well done. And it is a great turn from McDonald. If there is any justice in the world, she should get a huge number of offers on the back of this, but really, really good stuff.
Fantastic. So 4 stars for that.
Yeah.
4 stars also for God's Own Country. What would you recommend? If people were to see just one.
I mean, honestly, it depends on your mood. I think God's Own Country is a beautiful film, but it's more, you know, it's going to be slower and quieter and more kind of peaceful. Mm. And Patty Cakes is a little bit more in your face.
So it is.
But it's literally the difference between Yorkshire and New Jersey. So you've got to decide what you're in the mood for.
Which one's got Thomas Kretschmann again?
Stratton.
A Stratton Avengers Age of Ultron double bill. Ultron won't be in it though because I bought him for £4.50. I made that very, very clear at the beginning of the
movie. You did.
At the beginning of the movie?
Sure.
Is this a movie?
I hope not.
If it is, it's very badly written.
It's very badly everything. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by those lovable coves at Sky Atlantic. Do not forget that Tin Star, all 10 episodes will be available from September 7th, or you can watch it weekly from September 7th. It's entirely up to you. Right, that's it from us. It is goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to my local branch of WH Smith's. Don't ask what I'm going to be doing there, but it involves M&M's. Crispy ones are the best.
No.
Crispy ones are the best.
They're big. How do you even... Never mind. I don't want to know. Please don't tell me.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.